All right, well, it's just a few minutes after 6:15, and I think we'll get started. I want you to think about something for the end of the hour. I was talking with Paul Rohde. He says that these talks have been fine, but I also think that they could be more interactive, okay? And so I want you to, you know, I have one more talk tomorrow morning. And if you'd like to talk, as opposed to have me talk about the role of Catholicism in the 1950s, where JFK fits in all of that, and actually maybe have a textual dialogue about the speech itself, we can do that. Okay, so it's not just me saying, here's the state of American religious history, and here's how this president fits in, and here's what we're doing, but we could actually make it more a give and take. So think about it. My students would say, I'll take lecture any day, because then I don't have to think. But you're not my students, and I'm perfectly fine with that. Okay, so kind of think about it. Woodrow Wilson, this really ought to be Woodrow Wilson and the problem of religious rigidity. All right? And so I'm still searching for something I have found, Alan's story from 2 days ago, a Bible. All right, his Bible. I think Wilson would say this: I searched, I found, and there's no need to look further. And that, what I want to suggest is that in thinking about that, we have the roots of what's going to become Wilson's problem when we get to the Treaty of Versailles. All right? Woodrow Wilson does lots of good things. Woodrow Wilson is a very nice guy. He's clearly not as popular as Abraham Lincoln. But we're going to concentrate or focus on what's not so good. This is a letter that was sent to Woodrow Wilson before we enter war. All right? And I think this is important, that Woodrow Wilson is getting from the progressive wing of Protestantism letter saying, you know, my God, we have to get involved in this war. You must do the holy thing. You must lead us to war. And you know Teddy Roosevelt saying the same thing. So there's going to be a lot of pressure. And so one of the questions might be, why did Wilson wait so long? I want to begin with this. It's Alan's story represents kind of what Holden seems to be about. This kind of broadening of perspective, broadening of understanding. Wilson does not do that, and then we see that Wilson faces some serious pressure. All right, so for those that haven't been here before, for those that have been, thank you, and bear with me for just a minute. The first three presentations this week dealt with presidents who were orthopraxic in their approach. That is, they acted as Christians. That is, they acted as we'd want or we'd assume a good Christian would. But they could not or did not fit the orthodoxy test. That is, there's something wrong with their understanding of Christianity, that they could not belong to a regular church. All right? In the present context, they probably would never get elected. But we tend to think they're pretty good people if we look historically. Today's presentation and tomorrow's presentation are going to deal with the question of orthodoxy. Presidents who were orthodox in their religious affirmations. So they passed the orthodoxy test. The question one, and I'm not going to answer it, the question right that I want to leave you with is this the orthopraxic, are they practicing orthopraxy? Are they practicing what their faith maybe says they ought to be doing? Okay? Wilson is, for us, perhaps the most consistent of America's presidents religiously. You don't get a lot of waffle. He's not going to tell you one thing here and next year tell you something different. This is what I believe. This is what it means. Here's where we go with it. He's going to be very good at that. But Wilson is also the most rigid of presidents. And I'll have it in a slide down the road. But one of the reasons for that is Wilson does not operate very well one-on-one. He is wonderful in front of crowds. Put him in front of an audience and he can just do lights out orator. But put him in the same room with one other person and he became really defensive. He couldn't connect. I think this is the legacy of being a college president. But I don't think Rob Oliver would appreciate that. But we'll just leave it here. All right? And what I want to do is look at the one place this rigidity really rears its head, where it really becomes a problem, not just for the United States, but for Western civilization itself. Because what I want to suggest is in this rigidity that Wilson exhibits at the Treaty of Versailles, and I'm not blaming Wilson alone, okay, and I want to make this clear, I'm not blaming Wilson alone. What you have are the seeds for World War II. You have an explanation for the Cold War. You have the explanation for fascism and why Japan decides to do what Japan does. And so this is an idea where good intentions go wrong. And I would argue it's because of his rigidity. All right, people who were in here early, I love this picture. It has nothing to do with the Civil War. But again, I'm trying not to get on their internet particularly often. But this is, and you can't see it, it says, Vive Wilson. This is Woodrow Wilson arriving at the Paris Peace Conferences in January 1919. He's going to come as the savior, literally, of Europe. And this is this type of reception is going to, I mean, it's hard to believe. I don't think an American president has ever received a reception like that. Calais, he rode to Paris, and now it's January, and there were rose petals all along the route. Now, where they got rose petals in January, I don't know, but it gives us an idea of what they were expecting. And this is going to feed into Wilson's version. So we left off last night with the Civil War, and I talked about Abraham Lincoln and his perceptions of God, but I also talked last night about how the Civil War changed our understanding of things like marriage, heaven, other things. What I didn't mention is that in 1863, in the midst of this horrible carnage where you've got 20, 25, 28% mortality casualty rates in battles, in winter camps, there is a profound religious revival. And soldiers are going to leave the battlefield with this religious revival still in them. And if you've read Sam Watkins' autobiography, if you've read a little bit of Elijah Hunt Rhodes, but if you've read enough autobiographies, this comes through. Right? The standard interpretation is, you see all this much death, you expect it to happen to you, you want to get closer to your God. And that's likely the case. But one result of this call, this religious revival, is beginning in 1864 in a place called Zinnia, Ohio. Anybody from Ohio? Maybe I shouldn't say it that way. Zinnia. You get a group, the National Reform Association, and they present an amendment to Abraham Lincoln. It's an amendment to make America constitutionally a Christian nation. Right? It would have been, let's just call it Amendment 12A, if it had appeared before the 13th Amendment for ending slavery. Lincoln says, thank you, but he puts it in his pocket and it's kind of forgotten. And then he's killed. The association comes back in 1873. They reintroduce it. And there's this push to make America. Remember from last night, the North did not have God in the Constitution. It led to all types of debates between Confederate clergy and Union clergy about, were we a Christian nation, really? All right, so here's our answer. On the Southern side, the religious revival tends to end what became this Christian nationalism movement. That is, we are a Christian nation. And someone mentioned a book, I wish I could remember it, and I have appreciated the books that you've mentioned to me and the comments that you've given me, that one result of this is that Southern religion became more inward-focused, more focused on the individual church, the individual congregation, not so much kind of communion or civic-oriented. And one might attribute it to this kind of death of Christian nationalism. In the North, and it is the North, it is not the South. In the North, you begin to see after the Civil War, immigration, urbanization, industrialization, beginning to challenge our perception as a nation of what it means to be Christian and to be a Christian nation. Because who are the immigrants that are coming? For the most part, right, particularly after 1890, they become from Southern Europe, from Eastern Europe. They are Catholic or they are Jewish. They are olive-skinned, not white-skinned. They're not the traditional white Anglo-Saxon Protestants we're used to. And the Republicans had made a decision. They lumped Germans into the white Anglo-Saxon Protestants, but good guys. The Irish they lumped with other. Okay? And if you look at cartoons, they lumped them with other, and they lumped them specifically with African Americans. And so the Irish are always drawn in the 1860s, 1870s as African Americans. So they become, though they're from there, let's limit the Catholics coming. In the North, mainline Protestant churches, and I'm using mainline here to kind of, not new religions, those that see themselves as part of the mainstream of America's religious tradition, were beyond the divisions really between Baptists and Presbyterians in the early 19th century. Okay? For those that haven't been here, we're beyond it in the sense that we're not dealing with Orthodoxy anymore. Okay? We're Protestant. That's enough right now in the face of those Catholic hordes. But many mainline Protestant churches began to retreat. There was a conversation in the first day in the lecture on evolution about how it was that the fight between science and religion was allowed to go to the extremes, where you've got the atheist scientists saying there's no such thing as God, and then you have these kind of fundamentalists denying the importance of science. You know, that kind of middle shut up. And so it was here. The reason for this, and again, it's related to to the writings of John Fea and Robert Gamble, who I'll mention just a little bit, is that Protestants didn't quite know, these mainline Protestants, how to deal with the new immigrants. They didn't quite know what to make of them. If you can't see, just yell and I'll try to move. Okay? So what happens in this context? We've got a change. We have had a religious revival. We want to make America a Christian nation by constitutional amendment. And yet, my God let me down in the Civil War or held me up and we won. What happens? Well, among the most conservative religious groups, you're going to see the rise, and I hate to use the term now, but this is the term they used then, among evangelicals. Okay, World War I is kind of when evangelical in the 19th century term moved to fundamentalist in the 20th century. But they called themselves evangelicals. All right, so if you were, as most of you probably are, Lutheran, you would probably belong to a German Lutheran church or a Norwegian Lutheran church. You didn't belong currently to an evangelical Lutheran church. Okay, I don't have it up there, but for Lutherans, World War I is when the German language is outlawed for your ministers to speak, and the end of German publications for your newsletters, because it might be passing secret information. All right, and just as we had Freedom Fries, okay, right, the Frankfurter becomes the hot dog. So, what we've seen before, okay, we're gonna see, but Billy Sunday would be an example, right? Ex-baseball player who campaigns against temperance, or for temperance, not against temperance. And William Jennings Bryan, who kind of runs three campaigns as a populist, as a Democrat. Most Americans know him from Inherit the Wind. And he's kind of made a buffoon in that movie. But what these men do is they speak to rural, traditionally American, quote-unquote, constituencies. And they raise the specter of the city as evil. They raise the specter of what's happening as bad and say, look at me and my father-in-law's from Funk, Nebraska. You in Funk, you know. Oh, you can't believe all the Catholics out there in New York City. You can't believe... And so if you do this right, you will protect Protestantism against that group out there. The focus, as I say, is on temperance, the anti-immigrants, the farm crisis. There really was a farm crisis in the 1890s, particularly in places like Dakota and Nebraska. These are, right, many of the same issues today. In urban areas, and this is what history textbooks always kind of talk about, you see an attempt to adapt to new environments, to deal with the immigrant where they are. And what you get is the social gospel movement. This idea that we're going to go out and create a new millennium. Hull House is the most famous example in America, okay, with Jane Addams. We're going to teach the immigrants English. We're going to help them. What we're going to do is we're going to teach them how to vote. And in doing so, we're going to break the back of that ethnic political boss, the one who's producing corruption in America, the one who's keeping that immigrant kind of under their thumb. We're going to make them real Americans. The idea behind Hull House and others is to bring people, you know, bring the church to the people, to bring the church to where people are. In the 4 o'clock session on leadership and scarcity, I think it was, one of the people in that session was really talking about this. We see our obligation as a congregation, right, to get out and help that person. And how do we balance the community's needs with the structural or needs of our church to expand in size, to grow into its space? Right? This is what was happening. This notion of outreach is not new, but it becomes part of the mainline kind of Protestant movement in the post-Civil War period. So here's an example, right? A house of prayer for all. And we're going to take these in, can you see? We're going to take these immigrant children in, and we're going to teach them to be good Americans. And if we had more time, right, one could actually look at the fact that who's doing this? But the teachers are women. And so there's been this profound change in who's moral in our perceptions of religiosity, where for most of history, women were less moral than men. Now, by the end of the 19th century, women have become more moral than men. And this has impacts on divorce and where the kids stay. But it's women who are doing this work. And notice it's not at the pulpit. They're still not in the church. They're out the church, but they are doing God's work. Some have argued this is a legacy of the freedmen schools, where women went down and taught ex-slaves to read and write. Now, according to Richard Gamble, liberal Protestantism, these kind of social gospel movements, the churches of Teddy Roosevelt, of the Lodges, of the Vanderbilt, they're going to see World War I as a messianic moment where we can bring God's message to the rest of the world. We can bring them the progressive movement of their own. Now, the fact that Jane Addams had gone to London to study is it Addams House? Is that what it is? Is it Addams House in London? That she brought it. Doesn't matter. We've made it our own. We invented it. As the tensions of war mount and as Europe descends, I think is the best word probably, into World War I, you get the leader of the Federal Council of Churches, the National Protestant Organization, writing to his congregation, telling chaplains, pastors, you must preach that America must enter the war. That America has a moral, religious obligation to enter this war. Because we are a Christ nation to other nations of the world. You begin to see this language, and we've talked about it a couple times in the series of talks, right? Of not just American exceptionalism, but this notion of a city on a hill, that America is somehow divinely ordained by God, this providential notion. And so just as Solomon Ballou, that's their mob, that movie with Jane Fonda, Cat Ballou. But the guy that I played for you last night from the Ken Burns series in that letter, that he compared the Civil War with the American Revolution. If the American Revolution created the nation, veterans of the American Civil War had saved the nation. And therefore, and if you read the Grand Army of the Republic literature, there are all of these resolutions about how they ought to be given special privileges because they are, and this is their phrase, I'm not putting it, the savior of the nation. They have done, the South Dakota campus says, we have done God's work. You owe us pensions, or you owe us a veterans house, you owe us something. Woodrow Wilson, though he campaigned in 1916 on a he kept us out of war platform, was going around to churches and talking to congregations and the stump, and he would say, we are a nation with a special destiny. Teddy Roosevelt has argued that we need to get in the war. We need to show our manliness. And so what I want you to see is there's this increasing pressure to go to war. Now, there are lots of groups that are going to oppose American entry into World War I, like the two biggest ethnic voting blocs, the Irish, who hate England, and the Germans, who don't want to see us go to war against their kin. Right, so there are lots of countervailing arguments. But Wilson is aligning himself up with this kind of progressive Protestantism. The destiny, as Wilson saw it, was to spread Christianity abroad, American Christianity. If we are divinely ordained, we are God's chosen people, they can learn from us. And so, even before we go to war, you begin to see, and I'm sure it's probably, I'm jumping ahead, but you begin to see our arguments by churchmen that the Germans aren't real Christians. That the Germans are uncivilized. Now, we have real problems with the Brits, okay? Because the Anglicans, you know. And now, literature on the Anglican Church and World War I is undergoing a real revision right now, historically. The last 3 years have seen some real rethinking of what the Anglican Church did during World War I, and it's becoming clear that there are more pacifists among the Anglican leadership than they used to think. But it used to be that it's gung-ho. When war broke out, and this is Wilson's kind of choice of words. I couldn't find them together exactly, which is why I didn't put in quotes. War is a battle between, and I love this phrase, God and evil. So if we don't come in on God's side, we are
evil.
The dark empire, right? What's he beginning to do, right? This, we're entering the war for kind of messianic purposes. We're doing God's work. Now, for those that weren't here last night, and everyone's saying, okay, well, it can't be. I spent a lot of time talking about Lincoln's second inaugural address. We ended the class with that. And what I want you to remember about the second inaugural address is that Lincoln said, despite everything, we pray to the same God. We ask the same God for justice. That is, his God had not chosen the Union and said, you're the good guys, they're the bad guys. More importantly, right, the North, in Lincoln's second inaugural address, was paying the sin of slavery. That is, if it only Southerners had been the sinners in this, they would have suffered far more than they had, and we would have been better. But Lincoln, in his second inaugural address, has not separated God and good guys fighting on this side, bad guys fighting on this side. What we're beginning to see then, in this notion of American exceptionalism, is kind of a religious quality that did not exist before. If Germany won, Wilson began to argue, Christianity itself was at stake. Now, let's forget that Luther is German, okay? Let's forget all that stuff. Christianity is what we're fighting for. What is American Christianity? I hope that's not the next slide. But in Wilson's mind, Christianity cannot be separated from democracy. As Wilson sees it, democracy and Christianity are going to work hand in hand. So who are the Germans? They've got the Kaiser. Who are the Austrians? Well, they had the Archduke Ferdinand, all right, but they've got the last of the Habsburg rulers. Who's England? Well, they've got a constitutional monarchy and a prime minister. They're a democracy. Who knows what France has? I think this is the middle of the Third Republic or Fourth Republic. But we can say they're a democracy. So if I link these two together, I'm doing more than just spouting. I'm actually also espousing a political ideology. So here, see, I should probably just take my notes and sweat. What Wilson is beginning to do is blend patriotism and Christianity. Now, that's exactly what we saw in 2001 or 2003. Interestingly, right, it's not exactly what FDR did in 1941. He does not go out and say the end that they were devils and Christianity, right? He says we were attacked by an enemy, a dastardly enemy, but he doesn't immediately jump to this is a religious war. Now, I know lots of people say that's because FDR is not religious, but I think it's important that we know where these things, to recognize these things, where one immediately does and one doesn't. What Wilson argued in certain speeches is that you could blend the two, democracy and in his case America and Christianity, because both America and Christianity taught you to sacrifice for others, taught you to sacrifice for something larger, salvation or the common good. And so ultimately Wilson is saying what? That these tenets are the same, that it doesn't take much to be a participant in democracy and to be a good Christian. I don't have a good way to put it. But as Wilson saw it, and he did use the phrase kingdom of God. And if we go back, right, Jefferson saw God active in the world, right? Thy kingdom come was his Lord's prayer. And we saw that with Lincoln over the course of time where God was participating on both sides, but God had some role for us to play. If you think about the Gettysburg Address. What Wilson comes to say is that the United States is the closest thing we have right now to the kingdom of God on earth. And if that's the case, our destiny is to take what we have and bring it to the rest of the world. To be prophets to those in darkness. So, I'm going to talk about Wilson in just a minute. I want to kind of finish this out before we get to the specifics. And for Alan, can I just pick on you for just a minute? For those that had Alan, this is his first talk because he's been busy. What I've usually done is give background before I get to the kind of the specific parts of it. Okay, this is the historian. What Fia argues, and his book was America a Christian nation? He doesn't answer the question, okay, but he lays out some stuff. What Fia argues is that World War I moved evangelical Protestants into fundamentalists. And they're going to go underground in the 1920s. And tomorrow, right, I'm going to talk about John F. Kennedy and his speech to the Southern Baptists in Houston. And the argument's going to begin that this is the beginning of the coming out of this kind of more fundamentalist religious group, these religious groups, into the American politic. But from 1925 to 1960, they're really kind of marshaling and figuring things out. For liberal Protestants, the Hull House crowd, this is a chance to bring reform to the world, to end what we see is the problems. For social gospel advocates, what you see is the choice of the term righteousness. This is a war of righteousness. What Wilson comes to believe, and he's going to operate on this belief, as president he has a chance to operate on this belief, is that the war offers an opportunity to bring democracy and nationalism. Now, hear me out. Nationalism does not yet have the horrible connotations that it's going to develop in the 20th century. All right, that's a post-World War I development. When they talk about nationalism in 1914, 1916, 19, they're talking about the creation of a nation. Okay? And you have to think about the world in 1916, 1917. It is the Habsburg Empire, right? What set off the chain of events which led to World War I is this Black Hand, Gravello Princip was his name, shoot at you. He walked away the first time. The second time he saw the Archduke, he shot the Archduke, because he's Habsburg. He wants Serbia to be independent. It was a nationalistic tendency, just as we had seen in 1848. It is the Russian Empire, with parts of Poland, with parts of Estonia, with parts of Latvia, Lithuania, Ukraine. All right? Eastern Europe is a polyglot of empires. If I can bring democracy, and if I can bring a nation to these people, I will be doing God's work. It's a kind of secular vision of what will allow God's work to occur. Now, I think, in his heart of hearts, Wilson is hoping that they all become Baptist. Okay? That would be good. But he's willing to give it a try, and let's see what the Catholics can do over there and elsewhere. All right. I talked to someone this week, and she said, you know, the picture of Wilson when he was president of Princeton, he just looks like he has the most rigid back, that he's just been... And so this is Woodrow Wilson early on. What makes Wilson interesting, among other things, and we need to kind of remember this, he's the first Southern-born president since 1852. I know everyone's going through their presidential list, okay? 1852 is Zachary Taylor. Louisiana. Had never voted. He was kind of like Colin Powell. No one knew how he had voted or what he was running for until he kind of got in there. I mean, that's a great, and so the Whigs elected him. But every other president, right, even now, many were beholden to the South, even after the Civil War. Clearly, Buchanan, 1856, but in particular, Rutherford B. Hayes in the Compromise of 1876. So it's not that the South hasn't been important in electing presidents, but he is the first. So the Civil War is over. Okay? We've elected a knight now. He would not have become president if Teddy Roosevelt and Taft had not gotten a fight. The Bull Moon. Okay? That doesn't matter. Lincoln became president because four guys ran for president. Doesn't matter. He is the first Southerner elected. And he's elected because he's not perceived in the North as a Southerner. Okay? Do I have it up there? Yep. Before he became president, he was most famous first for being president of Harvard. And then in revising the curriculum, he became a progressive governor of New Jersey. All right? Regulating trust, cleaning up the sewers, that type of thing, stamping out bossism. so Northerners could see him as their own. Right? An example might be the way to think about George Bush. Both of them, right? Yale educated, living in Texas. New England can claim them, Texas claims them. But it's important politically that you not be associated. And so he appeals to Southerners because he's from Georgia. He's a Baptist. He's a vestryman in the Baptist church. Okay? And he appeals to Northerners. And he becomes president. And he is a progressive president. He does enact some sweeping domestic reforms. As he told lots of crowds, reform is doing God's work. In this sense, Wilson fits the mold of the progressive. If not believing in the resurrection was kind of standard operating procedure for Adams and Jefferson and 18th century intellectuals, here to be kind of in the group, in the intellectual elite, is to get behind reform. You don't have a lot of national politicians saying, oh, I think we should let the slums just kind of go their own way. And so you begin to see this. When he became president, and it's not obvious in 12, but it becomes more obvious in 1916, right? His religiosity, or this notion of progress, of doing God's work, has a negative effect. As Wilson evolved politically, if God is on your side, my side, then those who oppose you are evil. And it becomes a me, you, us, them. I'm right, you're wrong. And this is how Wilson is going to address the leaders of Europe and Asia when they meet in Versailles. Right? You saw that picture of all the crowd in front of him. He's got this kind of notion, the crowds behind him. It's to a certain degree perfectly understandable. Lots of Woodrow Wilson's critics, and there were many, always said Woodrow Wilson refused to compromise. He saw it as an affront to his kind of moral being. Now, you're thinking, I know, how does a politician get to be a president without making peace with others and making these compromises? Well, Wilson would say he never did. I was asked to be president of Princeton, and it was kind of a call. And then a group got together, much the way they did with Dwight Eisenhower in 52. They got together and said, you're a big name, you've got good press. You should be governor of New Jersey. And the Democrats looked at this and said, here's a way to break the Republican stranglehold. This is a way to undo the Republican stranglehold on Northern politics, a legacy of the Civil War. So I could say as Wilson, okay, but I don't have to make a compromise. You asked me to do it. I'm not out there asking for money. I've got a Mark Hanna backing me. Not Mark Hanna did not back him. Okay, so Mark Hanna is the backer of McKim. But this is how he becomes president as well. It's a call. It's a call. All right. So this is not the only picture, clearly, but I think this is fairly representative of World War I. If Americans did not think Europeans were stupid beforehand, World War I offered them proof positive that they really were. Because everything we associate with World War I, trench warfare, massive casualties, stupid trench attacks, artillery bombardments, submarines. We didn't have airplanes, but we had hot air balloons. Had appeared in Union and Confederate armies during the Civil War. Even how to mobilize the economy had been in practice. Okay? I mean, we could have told you what this war is going to look like. It's going to look like this. But does Europe care about America? And does America care? No. Right? We are an isolationist nation. We've gone our own way. And in doing that, we can be in our own minds, a city on the hill. But it was not a surprise to those in the know what evolved in World War I. And after the line stabilized in September of 1914, for most of World War I, the trench will not move more than 4 miles in either direction until American entry in 1917. We're talking about a front 475 miles, if I remember correctly, of trenches that kind of never moves more than 8 miles over the course of time. And so, you know, this is pretty ghastly stuff. America entered the war very late.
Could you say that again, just that quick fact?
So the trenches that we think about with World War I, if you've seen the movie Gallipoli, okay, which I think the ending, I'd love to show that to my class. It's a great example of both leadership and why Europe starts to disappear. But 475 miles, and the front in many places, not every place, but most places, never moves 4 miles from that stationary point for the next 3 years.
But mustard gas also affected...
Absolutely. Now, we didn't have mustard gas per se in the Civil War, so you've just trumped me. But mustard gas will move it. But how many of you have read All Quiet on the Western Front? You know, that's a pretty accurate description of how they move. If you think about, if you haven't read it, it's an easy read, okay? But they actually begin in the third trench, and then they move to the second, and then they move to the first, and they're kind of rotating back, and the only time he gets home is when he's wounded. So did that answer your question?
Mm-hmm.
All right. So let's think about it for a minute. Verdun, 1916. We're going to have 500,000 casualties in 6 months. We're going to blow so many German bombs from their artillery that the train tracks that these guns are on begin to sink. No big deal. We'll just put more train tracks and bring more guns and continue, okay? So how do I deal at Verdun with this kind of casualty? Oh, I ask the British, if I'm French, to launch the Battle of the Somme. 60,000 casualties the first day. 60,000. That's more than were officially recorded in Vietnam for the whole war. That battle lasts another 5 months plus, and there will be another 500,000 dead there. Now, that's not counting what's happening in Russia, say the Battle of Tannenberg. That's not talking about what's happening in Trieste in Italy. Europe is literally killing itself. And officers, the Eton crowd, the Oxford, Cambridge crowd, the officers, certainly of the British Army, are actually dying at a higher rate than the infantrymen. Because the officers, and that's why I like Gallipoli, if you remember the end of it, the officer of the line says, I can't ask my men to do what I would not do myself. So he takes his whistle, he puts his gun on the side, and he climbs up over the trench with the men who are about to be killed. Rupert Brooke, killed at the Battle of the Somme. I think it's the Battle of the Somme. Or Flanders, the Battle of Flanders. The English language's greatest poet at the time. How many Einsteins disappear in World War I? If you're British, France, or Germany. The point I'm making is, so when the U.S. enters, they enter 1917, the war ends with armistice in 1918. The U.S. misses all of that. By the time the U.S. enters, the Germans are shot. So are the English and French, but we're on their side, so it doesn't matter as much. And so America's going to come in fresh, strong, vibrant, rich, and they're going to have missed Verdun, Somme, Flanders. And they're not going to know, in all honesty, what they've missed. Wilson never understands the animosity that Lloyd George or Clemenceau have, okay? Now, when America came in, unlike World War II, America does not come in as an ally. We do not formally ally ourselves. We do not taint ourselves with alliance to those European nations. We are an expeditionary force, an independent force, and we pay a horrible price for that in our first go-round. They told us what to expect. We said, no, we're Americans. We know better. We sent our troops in. They got mowed down. Then we asked, and then we got better at the Ardennes for us, okay? But America, right, what I want you to see here is American exceptionalism at work, but it's also historically America's sense that we have to remain apart from Europe. Right? This is going to lead to the isolation that Americans want, the normalcy that we're going to want as a nation following World War II. When America, and I know someone's going to ask, I was looking for my notes, I couldn't find it. If you want to know them, wait till the end and we can talk. Under 14 points, right? His famous 14 points. Here's what we're going for. No, bless you. No secret alliances. Neutrality of the ocean. A League of Nations. What was most, but the two that are most important, no entangling alliances. The two that were most important are calls for Eastern European nations to be created. From Wilson's perspective, what he would call for nations to be allowed to exist. Altruism. We're going to do this and we're going to give them the nations that they so desire. And it's not a point, but it's part of the speech. A peace that is not a victor's peace. A peace among equals. Wilson, right, had been a professor of history before he became president. And this is the bane of all historians, right? They seem to move into academic administration. He had studied the British system, and so he'd studied British history. And what was the one treaty in Europe, recent treaty, that had really worked well? It was the Congress or Concert of Vienna of 1815, after the Napoleonic Wars. And what had happened? The victors, the quadruple, had allowed the French to sit in. They had had a say at the table. They had participated in the dividing up of their empire. And so the French could not complain about being kept out or shut out. So when Germany sued for peace, when they asked for an armistice was granted November the 11th, right, that famous line, the 11th hour, the 11th day of the 11th month. And if you're young enough, I would encourage you to go to the Tower of London on November 11th and take a tour. That it's such a point that you're on the tour at 11 a.m. It is stunningly moving. It was an absolute accident that I was there. My daughter was 4 and a half. She didn't quite understand what's happening. But the guards stop. The buses of London shut down, and it is silent. And you all respect a minute of silence for those who fell. Nothing that we do on Memorial Day fits, or Veterans Day, fits that kind of national. It is stunning. And it's worth, it's a bucket list kind of experience. But the Germans assume that because of America's strength, because of where America is, that this is what's going to happen. That the 14 points will be the foundation upon which we will solve this war. All right. So here's the picture of Wilson, right? Going in, and you can imagine, I mean, let's assume he's the least arrogant person in the world. But I'm walking in, I'm pretty happy here. They seem to like me. If they like me, their leader should do what they want, and they should like me too. In a democracy, if you like someone, you vote for them. So Wilson goes in, and very soon, he gets embodied, he gets entangled in this cartoon. You can't really see it. It's a cartoon on the League of Nations. And what you see are Asia, European allies, Europe, foreign nations, and I think this guy's supposed to be the Russian, tying him in knots. what Clemenceau, and I'm sure I got it, what Clemenceau and Lloyd George realize very quickly is that Wilson is blinded by his desire for nations and his commitment to the League of Nations. Because he sees both of these as doing God's work. If I can create nations, if I can create a League of Nations, I can help foster a better world. And if I can create and foster that better world, I will be doing God's work. So Wilson's trip is historic. Not, and this is a good reminder for us. It's historic not because of what's going to happen. This is the first trip by an American president overseas while he is president. We assume that's the norm. This produced all types of problems. Who's going to govern? Well, the nice thing is, really, no one has to govern in 1918, 1919. I mean, the federal government's not particularly large yet. But this was, you know, this is historic. This brings America into the modern age. Also right at this, the only nation that's not a debtor nation right now at this table is the United States. We have moved from being a borrower of foreign currency to being the world lender. And this is the beginning of Wall Street's importance in economic affairs. So World War I changes the economy. So this trip has profound economic implications. It has profound political implications. And what Wilson finds is that England and France, having borne such horrible, loss, has no interest in a gentleman's peace. This is going to be a victor's peace. And they make that very clear when they vote not to allow Germany to participate in the negotiations. They tell the German delegation, you know, nicely, it's good that you're here, we'll have an armistice, we'll have a treaty for you shortly. As Wilson got there, as Wilson begins, he says, look, America's the future. Europe, you need to look to us. You need to take our lead. We are what the future looks like. And it didn't matter if you were England or France or Italy or Japan. I don't want to hear that. Don't tell me that we're past. And so Clemenceau and George, and these guys don't like each other particularly, but they've worked together as allies during the war, and they're a little upset that America didn't join the alliance. They kind of get together and say, this is a nabob. This guy doesn't really understand foreign policy. This guy is, you know, he's new. And in essence, they begin to say, look, let's say we're not going to accept this. If Wilson demands this, let's just say we won't join the League of Nations. Or let's just say, you know, if England, if you want the German naval fleet, just say you won't accept Eastern European nations being created. He'll back down. And he did. Why? Because Wilson saw in this kind of notion of democracy and the creation of nations the beginning of the kingdom of God. The beginning of a kind of Christian experience. The result is a victor's peace. It really is. There's no other way to describe it. The German delegates come in, and you have to understand, it's not just a victor's peace. This is an embarrassment, and it's meant to be an embarrassment to Germany. The signing ceremony is in the Hall of Mirrors at Versailles. The very place that Germany had forced France to sign the treaty ending the Franco-Prussian War of 1871, the very place where William became first king of Germany. This is payback. This is not a new future looming. This is settling old scores. Wilson doesn't know this, but he's been duped. He's been duped. European leaders had played him as a rube. What I'd like to suggest is that his religious rigidity, his notion, his conviction that I know what is necessary to create, if you will, the kingdom of God, had blinded him to realpolitik. He didn't know how to play real politics. Now that's obvious, right? The United States does not accept the League of Nations. Right? He didn't bring a Democrat with him to Paris, and so the Democrat said this is a Republican treaty. I mean, even at home, he seems to have misplayed his hand. That's not... I'm going to get it wrong, okay? But I want to go back to, I think it was Monday's Bible study. And the phrase was right, the oppressor always creates, in a sense, the seeds of their own destruction or whatever. But you remember the kind of phraseology that was used. That within whatever you're doing, if you set it up this way, that there's the seeds of your own destruction. Well, history proved this. And again, I don't want to blame Wilson. I think there's more here. We've got a couple minutes. These two pictures are proof of this. Germany left, Versailles angry, mad, broke, owing. Ultimately, it was decided at the Reparations Committee of 1923 with John Maynard Keynes, about 5 billion francs. When asked about it, Keynes said, oh, it doesn't matter. The Germans can't pay it. Well, proved right. But Germany leaves angry, broke, frustrated. So did Italy, a victor. Why? Because the English and French pushed them aside. So what happens? Fascism appears in Italy in 1923. Why? Because Italy had been promised the region of Trieste. I'm sorry, had been promised to another country as well. Germany turns to Nazism in 1933, and we forget, right? Hitler was the chosen representative. He was not, he doesn't come to power by coup. Hindenburg chooses, he doesn't want to, but he's forced to choose Hitler. Why? Because Hitler argued that Versailles was a fraud and needed to be undone. And more importantly, if democracy means living up to the Treaty of Versailles, we don't want democracy. Because democracy, the Weimar, means acceptance of this treaty. So the victor's peace had ruined democracy, at least for the time being. In Germany. This was the best map I could find. It's not the best map, but it's going to serve my point. What about the countries that are created by plebiscites in what we now call Eastern Europe? Latvia, Lithuania, Estonia, okay, Poland, da 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 da. Wilson, to his credit, wants them to survive. He wants them as nations. So they don't care. What they want is a bulwark against communism. Right? The Russian Revolution is taking place in 1917. The Russians pulled out of our alliance. That's really why the Germans decided to unleash unrestricted submarine warfare against the Americans. They made a bet. They lost. But with Russia out, we can starve England and France and we'll win this war. They don't care about these nations. What they want is to isolate what's becoming the Soviet Union. And so they see these, they don't care about these as nations, as democratic success stories. They see them as a potential bulwark against communist expansion. And so the creation of these nations proved a fraud as well. They didn't care about them. And so their very existence was about, if you will, the great powers' political play, not about the wishes of the people on the ground. And so Versailles, the failures at Versailles, and there are many to go around, but I'm talking about Wilson. The failures at Versailles set the stage for the entire 20th century. And I don't mean to offend World War II veterans, okay? So This is why most historians now say World War I is the single most important war of the 20th century. It gives us all of the isms. Fascism, Nazis, and communism. It produces the Cold War. It produces all of these events, of which World War II is a major part. But World War II is not the cause of really post-World War II political development. So what I'd like you to see here is that in his zest for knowing what was necessary to create God's kingdom, Woodrow Wilson participated unwittingly, but did participate in a treaty that ultimately set the stage for many of the horrors that we associate with the next war. And that is a problem of being rigid and orthodox, in this case, a secular sense, a political sense. So the hour is up. We've got not quite 15 minutes. At least the bell hasn't rung for chapel yet. I thank you. If you've got some questions, whether here or privately, I'd be happy to talk about it. I have appreciated the feedback, even at lunches and stuff like that. So I hope you got something out of it. JFK and the Catholic speech to the Baptist is tomorrow at 11. And then I unfortunately am done for this week. So thank you. You've got plenty of time for getting to chapel.